Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
Hotu a geistocht le RTE Radio 1. Is feidir eistocht le Drama on One if we're in pod chreilta ag rte.ie/drama on one. Agus d'ar nó ar RTE Radio 1 íhanta dálnig. Tonight's play, A Red Romeo and a Blue Julian by Johnny Farrelly, is a comedic love story written in verse with a twist. Scoring is on everybody's mind when football hooligans Romeo from Rednavin and Julian from Blue Drogheda meet. Men who should be sworn enemies end up falling in love, and in the most unusual of circumstances. Listeners are advised that from the start, the play contains strong language and adult themes that some may find challenging. With an original score by Robbie Harris, this is A Red Romeo and a Blue Julian by Johnny Farrelly.
I've loved playing football since I was a lad. All the real aspects, both good and bad, swung with the punches, got them right back. I joined Navan Arrows, copped plenty of flack. Navan Arrows are hooligans. We fight once a week. We hit it head on and then turn other cheeks. They all call me Red Romeo, and it's what they think. I'm all about ladies and plotting for pink. But I have a secret, and no one knows. I plot for the gents, not like other arrows. I'm really a poet. My need to express, and so I make chance for others to belt. I've always invented because I love to rhyme. I'm a duck in the water, a tuna in brine. He's big, he's red, his feet stick out the bed. John O'Shea, John O'Shea. He's small, he's red, he talks like Father Ted. Robbie Keane, Robbie Keane.
They call me Holland, because Julian's me name. Shortened to Jules, no Dutch claim to fame. I've been a hooli for many a year. Dropped with the punches, tanked whiskey and beers. But I have a secret. It don't make me tick. I just like the friendship, the boozing and chips. I do get a buzz though. I do like the kick, but also the left hooks, straight rights and flicks. Straight right's a punch, and that's not me. I'm more of a lefty. I love hugging trees. I'm born to this shit. It's been all my life. I'm a fake tough guy, complete with fake wife. They call her a beard. It's complicated. I still truly love her. No way placated. Life is different. It's all a spectrum. People can fuck off and suck on my rectum. Okay, that's crude. Let me explain. I just want to live and have others refrain from judgment and gossip, from hearsay and shame. Shut up their opinions. Leave me to me game.
It's now 9 a.m. My ritual begins. I have a quick cup, a few old cheese strings, I do a few push-ups, grab a short blade, look in the mirror, remake my fade. I jiggle my eyebrows, I stare in my eyes, I massage my cheekbones and now realise that I'm getting older. This shit's wearing thin. I fight to make friends, I fight to fit in. I did love the thrill, it made me feel alive, but now I feel shit. I crave violence to thrive. I think I crave love now. I think I'd prefer to Netflix and chill, and my partner concurs. I'm now pushing 40. I've seen, heard it all. And now I crave solace. Just enjoy the ball. But not today. We're playing the Blues, and I want to smash them and force feed them shoes. I want to hit faces, I want to kick butt,
I want to break noses and keep their mouths shut. I want to slice them, make them all scream. Because that's what you get when you like a shit team.
It's now 9 a.m. This is a madhouse. My kids all get ready. All scream and shout.
Did you eat breakfast? You have a big day. Get them red bastards and make sure they pay.
And there's me wife. If she only knew. She'd eat me alive like a big Irish stew. But apart from the gay thing, I do really love her. I think it's just sad. We're like sister and brother. We have our 3 kids, our house in the burbs. We met in the stands and the story's absurd. We're standing and chanting. She was going mad. She threw a glass bottle and hit some big lad. The big lad came running and I was sat there. He runs and he grabs her and swings from her hair. And people just looking. They were all in shock. I jumped from me chair and I pulled off me sock. Golf ball in me pocket, threw in the sock and hit this big lad. Oh, he knew he'd been clocked. He hit the floor sharpish. We all just straight cheered. Karen looked up and saw me, and then she just leered. She asked me flat out, and I was confused, but accepted the offer. We went out and boozed. We went to the local. We had 7 pints. We went back to her place, and I spent the night. We kept seeing each other. I liked it that way. She's always a laugh, so I covered my gay. Then 6 weeks later, she found out she's late. She was now a child, and the feeling was great. We planned for our future. She stopped as a hoolie. We moved in together. The feeling was groovy. I didn't stop. I always kept fighting. The baby fulfilled her, so I'd go off to Brighton. Because being in Ireland, it was just too risky. I needed fulfillment, because I was clean frisky. I'd fly over to Brighton. They had a gay scene. Nobody knew me, so I felt a good lean. If I went out in Dublin, I'd just feel weird because Ireland's too small. They'd uncover my beard.
I've packed your lunch. A sandwich and banana. A scone for dessert without the sultanas. So go get your bus and get nice and ready. And say well to Brazzo, Chili and Teddy.
I run for the bus. Down Donore Road. Past Old Plunkett's Head. That mummified toad. So long to Drogheda, I see you tonight, after baiting some Reds and not taking their shit.
Now it's 11. Oh, the real day begins. I'll meet with the lads, Jay, Torpsy and Frings. We've cans stashed together. Booze through the banal. They're under a jersey right by Royal Canal. Hit the Talton at 2. It's up at the park. We'll be nicely oiled like a pumped Tony Stark. And we'll start our chants, of which I've prepared. Leave the Blues running all bloody and scared. We'll grind up their fingers and bite off their big toes. Open an orifice and stick in a hose. Ooh, ah, we are Navin. We love all women except cows in Cavan. Ooh, ah, we say it proud. There's only one gene pool for inbred love. Oh, me and the J, Torpsy and Frings. We decide on a place. Amongst other things, we do up some snow. Oh, the feeling is great. Now we can smash up those blue ingrates. Hooligans make plans. And we all text each other. If they weren't all blue, we could be red brothers. But I am a red. I'll be till I die. I'll keep fighting blues and making them cry. I'll stab out their eyeballs. Kick in their socks. Put cheese in their arses and glue on their cocks. Put salt in their wounds. Pins in their face. And I won't feel guilty because they're a disgrace.
We're now on the bus. This new driver is crap. He's gone the wrong way, and he seems in a flap. Now, 11 a.m, I'll get ready for war. We'll head on a pub crawl, Clems and O'Moores, keep saucing till kick-off or an hour before. We'll meet those red bastards and mop up the floor. My ex-best pal Finger was our fearless leader, the toughest mad bastard, a notable breeder. Everyone loved him because he was fair. He never judged no one, he just didn't care. 'Twas before I met Karen, felt safe around Finger. I wanted to tell him my feelings all lingered. I wanted to tell all, just stand up and say that I was different. A tough guy, but gay. I was gonna say it. It came from the heart. I thought they'd accept me and I'd still be a part of our old hoolies, as I'm still tough. They banter, still love me. Mess, call me a puff. About to come out to tell them my thing, we went to a match. Finger stood up to sing. While he was standing upon that cold seat, a fella just pantsed him, and then there was beef. They pulled down his trackies, and then we all saw that Finger had secrets that no one could claw. Because he was wearing a red lacy pair and fishnets and stockings, ladies' fine underwear. Some of us laughed. The rest were offended. They kicked him and punched him and he was upended. They shouted, "You faggot! You disgusting queer! We want you to leave and stay far from here!" So, that put an end to what I would say. I knew I could never come out and be gay. I knew I could never reveal who I loved. I knew I could never be real with these thugs. But I am a blue. I'll be blue till I die. And I keep fighting reds and I keep making them cry. Am I really a blue? Do they really want me? Or am I a phony? A fake and a Crombie?
Am I really a red? Do I really belong? I don't give a fuck. Just pass me that bong. Ooh, ah, up the ra. The blues all wear them knickers and bras. Ooh, ah, fuck those West Brits. Blues women have cocks and the men have tits. If I'm real honest, I don't really get it. What makes us different? And why are we vetted? Does fancying men make me less of a man? Or if I'm married to Danielle or Dan, I'm the toughest guy here. I'd smash all the rest. I'm better than all of them. But then, I digress. Let me tell you a story. Take you back just one day. I am in the George and I'm ready to play. I see David Norris. I go up for a chat. We sit and we drink and admire our hats. He tells me a story of a man and a lover. And he was well known to Ireland and others. It was Michael Collins. I couldn't believe it. But why should I not? Being gay can't achieve shit. Why is it a shock if our hero, great leader, fancied the odd man? Well, I'm a believer. Strong men can be gay. Gay men can be strong. We've stupid ideas. They've went on too long. Started by the church and became a big sin. Then people got screwed up and fucked up within. They tortured themselves, full of self-loathing. It leaked out in mad ways and sexual cloaking. They told us we're broken. They told us we're wrong. They told us the devil had possessed our dongs. They told us to choose to go back to women. They told us to clean up or else we'd be swinging. I haven't come out yet. Just convinced myself I'll leave all these hoolies and go out on the shelf. I just want acceptance. Be seen just like them, to love who I want, be it Glenda or Glenn.
Ha! Hop the ra! The Reds have nothing, nony our scars! Who? Ah! Fuck the Royals! The Reds' old scars are covered in boils! We ring up the Reds, get a meeting point. We're all sick with nerves as we pass back a joint. We slam our last cans and we don't complain. The beer and the smoke will all help with the pain. We roll up our sleeves, we show off our tats. We all thump each other to show that we're brats. And now as we walk, we march to our wars. We're bonded together, lined up in our scores. We'll fight for each other, for me and for you. That moment connected as we are all blue. As we turn the corner, I'm out in the front. I see this mad vision. This good-looking cunt. Was it love at first sight? I don't know, maybe. If I were a woman, I'd be having his babies. He was in a red top, but it was a retro. I hoped, prayed and pined that he wasn't a hetero. He was long, dark and rugged. A fighting machine. We'd go toe-to-toe and show him I mean.
As I turn the corner, I catch this lad's eye. He's wearing a blue shirt, but fuck, he's right nice. And though he's blue all over, but I'll get past that. I'd eat chips from his jocks and be happy to chat. I run up and face him. Square off on each other. We go toe to toe, we're not brother and brother. I see in his eyes that he likes me too. I see in his eyes that he's seen a fair view. Don't know what to do. I'm just standing still, all the hoolies around me. Their voices are shrill. They're thumping each other. They're shouting with glee. And I feel their eyes are now all watching me.
I hear all the others. I see all their fists. I see this head hooly and I want him in trysts. His eyes are like oceans. His fists full of fury. I'd mooch him right now if not for this jury. I pause in amazement. Feel our chemistry. And the hoolies around me are starting to see. They're thumping each other. They're shouting with glee. And I feel their eyes are now all watching me.
I panic and hit him. I go straight for the chin. He falls forward in shock and lands in a bin. He looks up at me and I give him a wink. He runs for the back street. I don't even think. I follow him round and he grabs me right there, pulls me in the alley, runs hands through my hair.
How did you know? Are you not scared?
I just got a vibe. I saw how you see me. I knew I felt something. An electric boomy.
And then my worst nightmare. I open my eyes and see in the front all the hooligan guys. They're shocked to their core and no one can speak. We're lost in pure silence, not even a squeak.
And just in that moment, I just had enough. I knew they were thinking, what's up, you dull puff? Fuck you looking at? I yell at the crowd. They're shocked into silence. Like no one's around. Oh, I can't hold it in. I start jumping and screaming. I see all the tough guys are quiet and preening. I scan the big group. See the biggest lad? I get in his face and I call him a cad. I threaten him wildly to come have a go or call me a faggot and get on with the show.
And then I just hit him right square in the jaw. He dropped like a stone. I heard someone guffaw.
Anyone else? Here you, wanna go? I'm ready for action. I'll go toe to toe. Oh, you're not so tough now. No one will speak.
No one has balls to turn of our cheeks.
Why you all judge us?
What's the big deal? It's nobody's business. It's just how we feel. So don't try and shame me. Don't start with your shite. We're the toughest men here. Any day or all night.
I felt pretty good. And I must admit, I feel a lot lighter. It feels like a gift. I feel I'm not hiding. I don't give a fuck. I've nothing to hide. No shame and no muck. Let's go do something. Some food and some beer. And let's do it proudly and embrace our queer.
I don't feel good. You've ruined my life. I have dependents, 3 kids and a wife. What'll they think? My kids will be slagged. My wife will be mortal. She'll feel like she's gagged.
Come on, come back. We're in it together. Let's embrace our feelings and change like the weather.
But I just left them. There was no going back. I kept walking and walking. My head was all jacked. I stopped in each pub. Got lost in the booze. I was not like him. He had nothing to lose. But I had my children. A wife who I loved. Even though we were lying, we had comfort like gloves. And now, as I walk, I just feel more shame. I feel everyone's eyes, and I know I'm to blame. I feel the self-loathing. I feel it so clear. If I had a choice, I'd never be queer. I'd just be a normal. I just love my wife. I'd never feel tension or want from this life. I'd never hear whispers, never feel out of place. Never wonder who knew or who I could embrace. Never feel I was worthless. Never feel I was weird. Never trick my good woman to act like my beard. Never worry my kids or what they will face. Never know if they know or they have the same fate. Never awkward in places and always feel free. Never know of acceptance from my family. And I carry this penance. I don't feel like him. I feel like I'm dead. And my life is now grim.
I heard all the rumours. I turned off my phone. I didn't say nothing till I got you home. I'm totally honest. I don't give a fuck. You're a good dad and I feel your luck. Don't let this take over. Don't let it define. Life is too short. Now, hand me that wine. Fuck all the haters. I'm still your wife. We'll make it all work. So let's just live our life. Let's not get too bothered. There's no need to stray. Death comes for us all at the end of the day. We've a family unit. We're unorthodox. Sure, we met in a fight, hitting lads with your socks. So we'll figure it out. Be mature and kind. Stick with each other. Support through the bind. Not pay attention to what others say. I'll get a lover. You're free to be gay.
I am shocked that you say that. I was fearing the worst. I thought you'd be raging, be screaming and curse. I feared it's the end. We couldn't go on. And the people would gossip and say I am wrong.
I understand logic. I know what others see. But life is on my terms. I want to think free. I want to be happy. I want my own terms. I don't mind being different in all I have learned. There is no heaven. There is no hell. This drop in the ocean is all I can tell.
That's real understanding. It's all shoulda, woulda, coulda. But I know we can make it. Because I'm now married to Buddha.
That was A Red Romeo and a Blue Julian by Johnny Farrelly. Joshua McEnany was Romeo and Fionn Foley played Julian. Karen was played by Aveen McCann. The music you heard was composed and performed by Robbie Harris. Sound supervision was by Pather Carney. A Red Romeo and a Blue Julian by Johnny Farrelly was directed by Ethna Hand. RTE Drama on One would like to thank Bohemians Football Club and all the staff and supporters at Dalymount Park in Phibsborough. And also, yes, the 2024 Sports Direct FAI champions, Drogheda United. Thanks to all the staff and supporters at Weavers Park in Drogheda for their courtesy and kind assistance.
rte.ie/drama on one.
And now, In the Wings. A programme where artists talk about their work and their journey towards performance. Tonight, writer and director Pat Collins and actor Michael Murphy talk about working on Eternal Lanes of Joy, a drama that recreates Patrick Kavanagh's epic journey on foot from his home in Inniskeen in County Monaghan to Dublin in the year 1931. Eternal Lanes of Joy, written and directed by Pat Collins, is next week's Drama on One.
My name is Pat Collins. I'm a film documentary director and a drama director, and this is my first foray into radio drama. The name of the piece is Eternal Lanes of Joy, which is a line from Prelude, a poem by Patrick Kavanagh.
My name is Michael Murphy. I play Patrick Kavanagh, younger and older.
Kavanagh is probably the first poet that I really took an interest in, I think, even as a teenager, before I was interested in poetry or before I was interested in reading, or I think Kavanagh probably reached me in a way that nobody else did at the time. So he's been there or thereabouts for as long as I remember.
The play is about journey that Kavanagh made when he was about 30 years of age, when he walked from his home in Inniskeen in County Monaghan into Dublin, ostensibly to visit or to meet A.E. Russell, who was the man who first published his poetry.
Kavanagh's walk to Dublin, you know, he was a working farmer at the time, and he did want to become a writer, and he was a writer, but he wanted to be a full-time writer. And I think he felt something inside himself that needed to break out. And A.E. George Russell had published Kavanagh in the Irish Statesman in 1929 or 1930. So I think Kavanagh, it was a very deliberate setting out to go and meet A.E. And then I think it was maybe either romantic or it was a kind of a pilgrimage that he decided that he'd walk. I mean, he had a bicycle, there was a train, you know, he could have gone other ways, but he set out. I think there was a romanticism as well about the beggar kind of lifestyle and being on the road. I think he talks about reading Jim Tully, and Jim Tully was an Irish-American writer in the 20s who wrote some great books about his journeys being a hobo in America. And Kavanagh had read him, so I think there was a kind of a romance, almost like an earlier version of the Kerouac on the road thing, you know.
Mum and Dad are both from Monaghan. Mum's from New Bliss and Dad's from Castlechaine. So I have a kind of affinity with it as a county, and I always loved it, you know, going there as a kid. Dad's people were farmers, if you like, so when we would visit during the summer, we would often be there with aunts and uncles and cousins and, you know, in farming situations all over the summer. It was idyllic, actually, bucolic, as the fella says. And I loved the landscape. It was a beautiful place to drive through all the time. People talk about it being the egg basket county. If you see it from the air because of the rolling drumlins, it's like a little basket of eggs. Green eggs, obviously, but eggs nonetheless.
I think he was very individual. And I think when he came to Dublin and when he moved from the farm in Monaghan to Dublin, I think he took stance, I think. And whether it came from insecurity or not, I don't know. But I think he made a lot of enemies very quickly. And I'm not sure that he was able to hold back in a way that other people kind of know when to remain silent. I think he had to be honest, I think, you know.
And at 14, I read Terry Flynn, and I was completely captivated then, because it was like, I'm a romantic comedy specialist, so if somebody puts a romantic comedy idea in my head, I just go, like, I cried at P.S. I Love You, which is a terrible thing to say live on the radio. It's a personal detail. I don't mind you printing that. But that's how bad I am in terms of romance. So when I read Terry Flynn, even though there are things in Terry Flynn which are things that nowadays we realise that actually behind of what Kavanagh was saying, there were things that we wouldn't approve of or wouldn't be able to stand over going on, it was still a beautiful book that a boy's head could get lost in the romance of it all.
I think it's just, it's so individual, so accurate. And that's why it's kind of universal, is that it's so accurate. It's kind of difficult to read now in terms of, you know, given recent, I suppose, developments in terms of the way we read old texts and some of the stuff that's acceptable and not acceptable anymore. I mean, you couldn't be publishing a book like Terry Flynn now for some of the references that are in it. But it's just the sheer electricity and energy that's going through the book. It's kind of like reading Pat McCabe or The Butcher Boy for the first time, and you go, my God, like the energy and electricity going through that. It doesn't happen very often, and it's pure personality, I think. And control as well, control of the material, but allowing that electricity and energy to come through. And I think Kavanagh and, say, Pat McCabe certainly have it.
I think there's a source there up in that, you know, hinterland, up in that in those townlands where the Heaneys start writing out of the Kavanaghs and the Kavanaghs start writing out of somebody else. But that coterie of people, the A.J. Cronins, the Kavanaghs, the Miles and the Gopalines, that gang of lads that were around in Dublin at the time, that literati, they were very, very influential.
You know, I do think he's a Catholic writer, and I think he is a kind of a peasant poet to a certain extent. But there are two aspects that, you know, Irish poets after Kavanagh are kind of shying away from to a certain extent. But Kavanagh wasn't worried about that, I think. He knew that he was being confined to being a peasant poet and resented that. But there was an awful lot more going on with Kavanagh than, you know, the small fields. And things like a sense of place are very important. And especially when you set out, I think sense of place are important. But you transcend sense of place too, so that every place, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, really, as Kavanagh talks about, you know, a lifetime to get to know a small field. And I think that's true, but it doesn't matter where the field is. In a way, it didn't matter to Kavanagh whether the field was in Monaghan or West Cork or Oklahoma, you know. He was influenced by where he came from, but he broke through all of that, really, to be that kind of universal poet who's celebrating the ordinary things in life.
It's been brilliant to work with Pat, because Pat is encyclopedic when it comes to Kavanagh. Will pull out, you know, something, you know, as we're making the piece, we'll pull out a new piece and say, actually, we might do a little bit of this. And, you know, it's a very malleable, flexible way of working. It's really terrific.
He does write in The Green Fool about his journey. I kind of feel that he's making some of it up as he's going along. And I kind of took that in good spirit and said that we can make things up as well. And so there's a reimagining of his journey. It's not 100% accurate to facts. We've made up kind of people that he might have met along the way, young woman, an old woman, blacksmith, and we've kind of dramatised those scenes of those encounters. And then it becomes very much then as well a kind of an internal monologue, I think, that the actor Michael Murphy inhabits Kavanagh as an older man and as a younger man.
I work a lot on my own. I do a lot of solo shows, but this is like, this is ideal for me in terms of just being able to arrive into a place like, okay, I thought the other day, so I was going home and I was thinking, okay, the universe is saying, Michael, you're about to die. And why are you about to die, Michael? It's because I was put in RTE to do a radio play and I was visited here. You know, I've been here 3 days on my own, but I get visited every couple of hours by people I love. Now, some of them I've never met before. John Connors, amazing man. Brilliant, brilliant performer. John McArdle, whom I've known for years and I'm very, very fond of him and Tommy. Catherine Walsh, who I've soldiered with in the New Electric Ballroom. Rosaline Lennon in the same play. Eamon Owens, who nearly drowned me in the middle of the Butcher Boy film. Eamon Hunt, who I've known for years. Like Charlene McKenna, everybody from past lives, beautiful, creative past lives, has been brought in here during the week to work with us. So I think the universe is going, okay, Michael, your time is up and we're just going to bring you all these lovely people for one last time to see them all. But it's been brilliant. It's been brilliant.
I was actually on holidays in Spain and I was reading Laurie Lee's book as I walked out one midsummer's morning. And I was kind of lost in that and I was really enjoying it. And I had a memory of reading, probably from Antoinette Quinn's book, about him walking to Dublin. Kavanagh took 3 days to walk, 2 nights and 3 days. And Maybe it was just the kind of the being in Spain and reading that book of Laurie Lee's, which is about his journey through Spain, which was around 1934. And I knew that Kavanagh had walked to Dublin in 31. And I didn't really want to do anything on Laurie Lee's journey, but I thought in an Irish context, it'd be ideal to do something with Kavanagh and try to recreate the sound of Ireland in 1931. For radio. It's not something that I'd feel that would work on film. And I think the freedom of radio actually would be great for it. So I contacted my friend Kevin Bruin in RTE here and just said, what do you think of the idea? And he was very encouraging. And then I was up in the Patrick Kavanagh Centre in Inniskeen and talking to Darren McCreesh there. And he liked the idea and he gave me some development money. And then so with Kevin and with a script, we kind of applied to BAI and we got funding for it and off we went. It was very important for us, I think, to record some of the journey, like on the roads themselves, you know, up around Inniskeen. And from very early on, I kind of thought, you know, there's a scene in it where he's leaving for Dublin and he's having a discussion with his mother saying, I'm going to walk to Dublin and meet AE. And I just thought it would be great opportunity to actually set that scene in the kitchen where it would have happened. And we approached the family and asked them if we could record. So we got the actor Michael Murphy playing Kavanagh and Catherine Walsh, the actress, playing Mrs. Kavanagh. And we recorded that scene up there one evening in September. And being in Kavanagh's house, it was kind of an amazing thing to be in the actual house where Kavanagh would have written his early poems. And just to kind of, the old walls are still there. You get still, it's a very modern house now, but you still get the old part of the house. And there's the thick walls of the cottage. And it was just a beautiful sound in there. And kind of a deep kind of silence, you know.
So I was in UCD for a while. Jerry Stembridge was a producer here at the time. He saw me in a couple of plays when I was in college. And he started my formal professional acting thing, if you like, because he offered me a job in TV.
In 1988, I would have researched and written a kind of a local book in Drimaleague in West Cork, which was a kind of a history of the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the Clonagail GAA Club. And I kind of compiled it together into a book, which was a very kind of rudimentary book, really. But it kind of did give me a taste for research and for writing. I think research more than writing. And I had an inkling for that. So I ended up going to Galway, to the Galway Film Centre, and did a 6-weekend film foundation course.
Jacques Lecoq is a school in Paris. It has moved to Avignon, actually, in recent years. But it was an extraordinary school, and he was an amazing guru. He began, actually, his career, if you like, as a physiotherapist, effectively, and re-educating people who had been injured in the war to mobilise and walk again. And then he began to study movement more keenly and graduated from, you know, the kind of physiotherapy end of things into movement for theatre, and then became one of the most, you know, lauded and respected, you know, teachers of movement in the world. And so effectively I went to train as an actor in a school where the training for the actor was done almost entirely and exclusively through movement. So we weren't big text people. Text came later, but if you like, in theatre work, it's important that actors work with text, subtext, but they must also work with the language of the body and the subtext of the body. And they're very complex. That's a very complex combination. If you get them all right, there's a strange authenticity to the performance. But if you ignore the body and the subtext of the body, then you're losing out on 80% of communication. So it was an extraordinary place to be. It was multicultural. It was really, really vibrant, and you just saw styles of theatre that you would never have seen just through people who are, you know, who are your fellow students.
And then very gradually I became an editor of a film journal in Galway, and then programmed the Galway Film Festival. And my first documentary, I was nearly 30 when I made my first film, and that was on Michael Hartnett, called Necklace of Rins. I'd loved Hartnett's poetry, you know, kind of all through my 20s, and he was such a kind of an interesting individual. Again, not unlike Kavanagh in some ways, where he kind of went up against maybe whatever orthodoxy was there at the time, you know, giving up writing in English and going back to Irish, and I mean, I suppose political as well in his own way. And I think Kavanagh in the same way was kind of going up against the orthodoxy. You know, the Celtic Twilight, I think, was a kind of an important movement, and the Gaelic Revival was an important movement. But Kavanagh, I suppose, just reacted against it, I think. And under different circumstances, I think if he was born 20 years earlier, he might have been part of it, you know.
I guess when you train in École Jacques-Lecoq Paris, you aren't just a performer, you're an originator of material as well. You constantly make work. So you begin a week and you make work, themed work, for the end of every week for criticism with the teachers at the end of that week. And it means that everybody becomes a writer, everybody becomes a director, everybody becomes a performer. So you're kind of multifaceted when you come out of the place. And I think it's only natural then that, as well as being a performer, as well as being an actor, you know, and I make a distinction between actors and performers, but as well as being both of those things, when you come out of Lecoq's, you end up with this other desire, need, I suppose, to explore and continue to create work. And sometimes I get to do that by directing, because, you know, there's another, you know, aspect to theatre where, you know, the director is supposed to have an overall vision of what the production is there to do. I get to do that, but I also get to self-direct in one-man shows, which I've written and created as well. So the creation of those one-man shows is a combination of me writing and then, if you like, taking off the writer's hat and forgetting that I did write it, and then going into a studio and directing myself in the movement sequences of the plays. And with my one-man shows, I play multiples of characters in those shows. So there's The Man in the Woman's Shoes, I Hear You, Andrew Joyce, and the latest one, which is called The Mysterious Case of Kitsy Rainey. And in those shows, I probably play 30 characters over the course of the shows. So it's kind of important that I'm able to make very quick, very visual representations of characters, not just vocally, but physically, to give the audience the possibility of seeing them all. So I can change between 3 or 4 characters in 5 seconds. And it's not up to me. I may have a facility to do that, a certain ability, but I know that the audience will see them, that I can show them those characters as fast as I want and they will see them. That's the gift of the human imagination. And you discover very quickly through intuition, as you have that experience as well, where you can tell when something sits down. The audience, they let you know that, okay, you know, we've heard enough now, move on, please. Or else stay with us a little bit longer there, because we haven't had the time to process that idea. So after the first 3 or 4 shows, you kind of go back into the studio in your head and redirect yourself slightly, or make little notes to yourself. And my partner, Ethna, is fantastic at this sort of stuff. She's a brilliant editor. So when I'm writing and I'm producing final scripts, she'll do final edits with me. Curiously, I wouldn't say directing oneself, I would say it's more about just inhabiting, just getting up on the floor, walking around the place and letting your intuition guide you.
I think it's trying to be influenced by life, I think. Be influenced by your experience of life. And I think maybe that's why I like Kevin in some ways. It's everything is kind of filtered through him. And I think kind of having some sense of the transcendent, I think, is the thing that that Kevin is after all the time. There's a book by Una Agnew as well, which is about Kavanagh, and she writes about that element of Kavanagh, which is, it's semi-religious, but it's universal, really. It's not just about the Catholic religion, or it's not about the one true God. It's about loving the small things or the ordinary things. And I think that's what Kavanagh was supremely good at, and I don't think anyone's ever kind of matched it. I think, you know, there's been a lot of great Irish poets, but I think Kavanagh had something. Heaney talks about this, I think, in terms of the sense of place, where a lot of the poets are kind of up on the kind of hillside, looking back and forth in time, looking at history and geography and all the different disciplines. Whereas, like, Kavanagh is kind of like the flower that's springing straight out of the ground. You can't really replicate him, because he is, you know, I think, rather than being a writer who's trying to be about something, he just is, you know.
That was writer and director Pat Collins and actor Michael Murphy talking about working on Eternal Lanes of Joy, next week's Drama on One.
rta.ie/drama-on-one.
And if you're a candidate for this year's Leaving Cert English paper, you'll no doubt be aware that the prescribed Shakespeare play is King Lear, a portrait of power, hubris, greed and betrayal. This play, written by Shakespeare in 1606, is a total work of fiction and, as such, is completely far-fetched. I mean, imagine, in this day and age, a land ruled by a leader so self-regarding that he bestows favour only on those who flatter him. Imagine a leader so vain that he'd subject his subordinates to a love test where lavish praise, no matter how insincere, is demanded, and those who demur are banished. Imagine a leader whose most valued confidant is, well, the fool I mean, you couldn't make it up. No one would believe you. Here's an excerpt from the 1962 RTE archive production of King Lear, starring Ainu McMaster. Who did you say is coming?
The king is coming. Attend the lords of France and Burgundy, Gloucester.
I shall, my lord.
Meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. Give me the map there. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, whilst we unburdened crawl toward death. Our son of Cornwall, and you are no less loving son of Albany, we have this hour a constant will to publish our daughter's several dowers, that future strife may be prevented now. The princes, France and Burgundy, great rivals in our youngest daughter's love, long in our court have made their amorous sojourn, and here are to be answered. Tell me, my daughters, which of you shall we say doth love us most? That we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge. Goneril, our eldest born, speak first.
Sir, I love you more than word can wield the matter, dearer than eyesight, space, and liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honour. As much as child e'er loved or father found, a love that makes breath poor and speech unable. Beyond all manner of so much, I love you.
What shall Cordelia speak? Oh, love, and be silent.
Of all these bounds, even from this line to this, with shadowy forests and with champagnes rich with plenteous rivers and wide-skirted meads, we make thee lady. To thine and all but is this jubilee this perpetual. What says our second daughter, our dearest Regan, wife to Cornwall?
I am made of that self-metal as my sister, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart I find she names my very deed of love, only she comes too short. That I profess myself an enemy to all other joys, which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear Highness's love.
Then, poor Cordelia, and yet not so, since I am sure my love is more ponderous than my tongue.
To thee and thine hereditary ever remain this ample third of our fair kingdom, no less in space, validity, and pleasure than that conferred on Goneril. Now our joy, although our last, not least, in whose young love the vines of France and milk of Burgundy strive to be interest. What can you say to draw a third more opulent than your sisters? Speak.
Nothing, my lord.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again.
Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less.
How, Cordelia? Mend your speech a little, lest you may mar your fortunes.
Good, my lord. You have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as are right fit, obey you, love you, and most honor you. Why have my sisters husbands, if they say they love you all? Happily, when I shall wed, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Sure, I shall never marry like my sisters.
But goes thy heart with this?
Aye, my good lord.
So young and so untender.
So young, my lord, and true.
Let it be so. Thy truth, then, be thy dower, for by the sacred radiance of the sun, the mysteries of Hecate and the night, by all the operation of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be, here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold thee from this forever.
Good, my liege.
Peace, Kent. Come not between the dragon and his wrath. I loved her most, and thought to set my rest on her kind nursery. Hence, and avoid my sight, so be my grave my peace, as here I give her father's heart from her. Call France. Who stirs?
I, my liege.
Call Burgundy. Cornwall and Albany, with my two daughters' dowers, digest this third. Let pride, which she calls plainness, marry her. I do invest you jointly with my power, preeminence, and all the large effects that troop with majesty. Ourself, by monthly course, with reservation of 100 knights by you to be sustained, shall our abode make with you by due term. Only we shall retain the name and all the addition to a king. The sway, revenue, execution of the rest, beloved sons, be yours. Which, to confirm, this coronet part between you.
An excerpt there from the 1962 RTE archive production of King Lear, starring Ainu McMaster. The play is available on the RTE Drama on One website, where you can also hear over 60 podcasts on King Lear, including sample answers, scene studies, theme explainers, favourite quotes, not to mention the King Lear quiz, where, just like the Leaving Cert, all your favourite questions come up. That's all available on rte.ie/podcasts or search Lear in Lockdown in your podcast app. And you might like to know that the Gate Theatre's production of King Lear continues until the 27th of April. Details on the Gate Theatre's website. Next week's drama on One is Eternal Lanes of Joy, written and directed by Pat Collins. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds.
Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on One.
Drama on One.